A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Willie, Harry, Stee, Harry, Dick, John, Harry, 3, 1, 2, 3, Neds, Richard, 2, Henrys, 4, 5, 6, then who? Edwards, 4, 5, Dick the Bad, Harry's Twain and Ned the Lad, Mary, Bessie, James, Evain, Charlie, James again, William and Mary, Anna, Gloria, 4 Georges. We are still working our way through the Georges, and it's taking even longer because I've split poor old King George III into 2 parts. Why do I call him poor old George III? Well, because he suffered from terrible mental illness for a significant part of his life. And although he is still our longest lived and longest reigning male monarch, I don't think you could say that that was a completely happy reign. And certainly during the latter part of it, he was not really in control. His son, George, the Prince of Wales, acted as his regent in a period which became known as the Regency. I'm not particularly going to go into the Regency in this episode. We'll save that for the next episode about George IV, because the Prince Regent went on to become the monarch, which is not always the case. Sometimes they die before they can take power. So this is George III, Part 2. And in the previous episode, we took George up to the outbreak of the French Revolution, although with my guest, James Horse, we did jump ahead a little bit to look at the Acts of Union. So let's pick up with the French Revolution. Now, British politics at this time is dominated by the Tories and the Whigs. I think we all know what a Tory is, and a Whig is basically anyone who's in opposition to that. They are the more, I suppose, forward-looking politicians who want more radical change in the country. They're probably what are now lumped together as the North London metropolitan elite, and the Tories as the stuffy gamins. So at the time of the French Revolution, the Whigs were all for it. They were saying, at last, some progress in Europe. Why has it taken them so long? We had our revolution 150 years ago with Cromwell, the Civil War and the brief period of the Commonwealth. And although we brought the monarchy back, we brought them back with severe restrictions. The British monarchy is very much a constitutional monarchy. They rule by the consent of Parliament, really, and they have to stick to a set of rules and laws set down by Parliament. So they can't just make decrees and do things off their own bat. They can try and influence Parliament, yes, but they are not all powerful. France, since the creation of their kings, had an absolute monarchy. The king was in sole charge of the country and could decree whatever he wanted. This was fine when things were going well, as under, say, King Louis XIV, the Sun King, who really made France this massive dominant power on the world stage. But his successors, the next two Louis, were by no means as powerful. I mean, you can look at what's going on in Russia today, I suppose, as a certain sort of parallel. Putin is not a monarch, but he behaves as if he is. He has so-called elections and he has a parliament in place, but they basically do whatever he says. And he will hang on to power as long as he acts in a powerful way. Once that begins to slip, and it will ultimately slip, all of these rulers descend into old age decay, if they're lucky, or otherwise they get assassinated. Who knows what will follow Putin? But in France, we get this position where the French have been involved in these incessant wars in Europe. And I will be releasing a side episode where I talk to Dan Snow about these wars in Europe, which became world wars. So make sure you listen to that to get a better grasp of what was going on here. First of all, we have the War of the Spanish Succession. The Spanish ruler dies and there are two separate rival claimants to the throne, one of whom is French. And the rest of Europe thinks we don't want a French ruler on the Spanish throne because that would make France and Spain this massive power block. And so they all go to war over it. The British send in the Duke of Marlborough and he becomes this great military hero. And he, along with the other powers in Europe who were in opposition to France, do manage to ultimately win the War of Spanish Succession and impose certain sanctions on France through the final treaty. Once you do this, the defeated side is never going to be happy. They will always be wanting to come back. And this is what happens in the Seven Years' War, where France again makes certain alliances, tries to expand, tries to knock back the Germans, the Holy Roman Empire, the Dutch, the Austrians to the east, the Prussians get drawn into it, and ultimately the British get drawn into it. First of all, by what's going on in America, where the English colonists are in conflict with the French colonists, and so an English army is sent over to help them. And if any of you have read the book, The Last of the Mohicans, or seen any of the TV series or films, that is set during this war in America, primarily between England and France on American soil, and each side hiring rival Native American tribes to fight for them. And the siege of Fort William Henry that is central to the story is actually based on historical fact. It was an English fort that was famously besieged and overrun by the French with the aid of their Native American mercenaries. And afterwards, the English prisoners were attacked by the French Indians, as they were called at the time. And that massacre is at the heart of James Fenimore Cooper's story. Indeed, the incidents at the fort were one of the main reasons that the British sent over a lot more troops, and they eventually beat the French and win the war in America. But on the back of that, it kind of spreads to Europe, because England is fighting France already, so suddenly they are fighting France in Europe. But the English quite cleverly, I keep calling them English, no, they should call them the British. If I call them the British, I call them the English, I'm talking about the same thing. Apologies to Scotland, Ireland and Wales. But the British have this policy of trying not to get too involved in these European wars. They will send over some forces to bolster certain parts of it, and the Hanoverians, the Georges on the throne, are always getting into trouble for trying to support Hanover in Germany. And some of Parliament, some of the people are saying, you just care about Hanover more than you care about Britain. But yes, they are trying to stop Hanover from falling to the French. But they start to introduce this policy of basically financing other people in Europe to fight on their behalf. And they latch on to Frederick the Great, the ruler of Prussia, who is a grandson of George I via his daughter Sophia of Hanover. And Frederick is a great military leader, a great general, a great strategist. I mean, He'd have been stuffed if the British hadn't been bankrolling him, which had long-term consequences that I won't go into here. But with our financial backing, he goes great guns, allowing the British Army to concentrate on securing the colonies in North America, the Caribbean, in Africa, and increasingly in India. And as in America, the French have a big presence in India. And originally, the East India Company is fighting the French. They are a trading organization, but they also create one of the largest armies in Europe, a private army. And they're fighting the French, and eventually the official British army is dragged in and they take over from the East India Company in India. So all of this is going on. France is at the heart of it, and France loses pretty badly. They lose their hold in India. They lose their hold in North America. Canada becomes British. The rest of North America becomes essentially English, although the local indigenous population might say differently. And they are defeated in Europe, which does not go down well with the French people. It also means that they have spent vast amounts of money and they are economically ruined at this stage. So there is a lot of discontent in France. There is a lot of anti-monarchical feeling. And in Paris, various politicians, journalists, lawyers start organizing an official opposition to the monarchy, which explodes into this great popular uprising. First of all, there's a huge political gathering at the Estates General of 1789. Then that proceeds to the storming of the Bastille, a declaration of rights. The monarchy was abolished in 1792 and King Louis was locked up. And in September of that year, an army of Prussians and French loyalists started advancing towards Paris. The French revolutionaries, sometimes called sans culottes, which means without breeches. I mean, if you picture the classic Georgian gentleman's outfit, it's those tight knee breeches and stockings. Well, the ordinary people of Paris just wore long trousers, pantaloons, none of your fancy culottes for them. Anyway, they essentially kind of panicked. They started massacring the aristocrats who'd been filling up the prisons and killing people on the streets who they thought were counter-revolutionaries. And this became known as the September Massacres. There was no going back from this. Louis was executed the following year in 1797, followed by the Reign of Terror, where the guillotines were working flat out. And in 1799, Napoleon seized power in a military coup, known as the coup of 18th of Brumaire. Because, and it's quite interesting, one of the things that the revolutionaries had insisted on was their own new fancy revolutionary calendar. And the names of all the months were changed to demonarchize it, to modernize it, to revolutionize it. And they also tried to bring in a decimal system whereby the day was divided into 10 hours and 100 minutes. Inevitably, it didn't last long. When you've got a pretty standardized system throughout Europe, where November, for instance, is Novembre, the original ninth month of the calendar, calling it Brumaire didn't catch on. You can't just suddenly rename the months and expect everyone to go along with it, like, I don't know, call March Monthy McMonth Face. And yeah, I mean, the names they came up with, they sound a bit like the names of perfume or bath oils or scented candles. Vendomière, Brumaire, Frimaire, Niveuse, Pluviose, Germinal, Floréal, Prairial, Messidor, Thermidor, Fructidor. But essentially, the new regime are trying to completely dismantle the old aristocratic system in France, the Ancien Régime. I think maybe they looked at what had happened in England and thought, if we leave this whole apparatus in place, then the system will just reset to what it was before, even if we get rid of the king. So they do set about really trying to take things apart. And the two original kind of instigators, leaders behind all this are Danton and Robespierre. And as is often the case in these revolutions that go quite far, that become quite violent, is everybody gets sucked into it and everybody starts accusing everybody else. Look at what happened in Russia with the likes of Trotsky. The same thing happens in the French Revolution. Danton and Robespierre are both eventually arrested themselves and guillotined. So there is chaos in France. And back over the Channel in London, even the Whigs, who'd originally supported the revolution, are starting to think, uh-oh, this does not look good. What if this complete anarchy spreads to Britain? We'd all be rounded up and carted off in the tumbrils, because the Whigs may be in opposition to the Tories, but they are still a bunch of toffs. And even in France, the people at the heart of the revolution, those that haven't already been executed, like Danton and Robespierre, are thinking, this has got out of control. We've got to do something to dampen down this mob fervour. If we can't have some kind of order, all these surrounding countries will just march in and take over. And maybe there's a feeling that attack is better than defence. Maybe there's a feeling of we must spread this revolution, encourage the people in other countries to rise up and get rid of their own monarchs. And so they declare war on all and sundry to protect their borders, to protect their revolution, and also partly to get rid of some of these troublemakers. Rather than having them get involved in what could develop into a huge civil war in France, is send them off to fight other people. And so that's a good way to keep the troublemakers out of Paris, is to have them fighting in foreign lands. And if any of the French commanders get too powerful, it's also probably a good idea to have them sent away so that you don't risk some form of military coup. And this is exactly what happens with Napoleon. The French had seen it coming. Here was this Corsican officer who displayed a great flair for warfare and quickly rose to become more and more dominant. And so he was basically sent off to fight in Egypt, to keep him out of the way, to keep him as far away from Paris as they could. He could go fight against the Ottoman Empire. Ultimately, the plan out there was to cut a way through to India and take on the British there. But first, Napoleon wanted to smash up the Egyptian Mamelukes and the Ottoman Turks. By this time, Napoleon was feared by the other European rulers. They also feared, as I've said, that the revolution could spread. And in England, the landowners, who have made themselves incredibly wealthy by taking over common land and exploiting it, and through the burgeoning industrial revolution, the last thing they wanted was to have their land and wealth taken away from them. Something must be done. So the British start trying to make these alliances, these coalitions with other powers to counteract the French. So the French Revolution kicked off in 1789, and 4 years later, France declared war on Great Britain in 1793. In response to that, George and his Prime Minister, William Pitt the Elder, arranged to increase taxes, raise armies, cut down on certain legal rights that people had. Was it using the war as an excuse to bring these things in? Or did they really think, oh, we're at war, therefore we need to behave in a much more authoritarian manner? But it led to crowds attacking George's carriage in 1795 on his way to opening Parliament, saying they wanted an end to the war and lower bread prices. So very much the sort of grievances that the French working classes had had. How does Parliament react? With even greater authority. They passed the Treason and Seditious Meetings Act. You can see the parallels with what's going on in United Kingdom today in response to, well, it's a war in the Middle East. But there are protest marches about what's going on, and the government is saying, we mustn't allow this to descend into anarchy and chaos. We must pass some more authoritarian acts and bills. And you think, well, come on, this is not the same as a threat of invasion from what was the most powerful country in Europe. It is posturing on behalf of the government. But anyways, Britain makes a coalition with Austria, Prussia and Spain. This is known as the First Coalition. Oh my God, there is definitely a mastermind specialist subject on this. I think there are in all about five different coalitions that the British put in place to try and oppose revolutionary France and increasingly oppose Napoleon. That first coalition fell apart in 1795 when Prussia and Spain decided to make their own separate peace with France. So Britain makes a second coalition, this time with Austria, Russia and the Ottoman Empire. So this huge power block, well, in the Middle East and right up to sort of Hungary and Austria, the British are prepared to go into a coalition with them. But that coalition is defeated in 1800, at which point Britain is left fighting alone against Napoleon Bonaparte, who by this time has become the first consul of the French Republic. So what does William Pitt do? He says, let's make another coalition. This is the third coalition, this time with Austria, Russia and Sweden. And this, just to be clear, is William Pitt the Younger, although he is by now in his 40s. And now that third coalition falls apart in 1805. So really what happens is all these other countries are saying, look, we don't really want to be fighting France. I think we can contain them. And Britain is saying, no, this guy Napoleon, if he is left unchecked, he's going to cause huge problems. I mean, so many parallels with what went on with Hitler in the 20th century. To the extent that one of the things that eventually leads to Napoleon's ultimate defeat is that he foolishly decides to invade Russia in 1812. But that comes later. So this is all going on as a result of the French Revolution. To backtrack slightly, in 1800, the British and Irish parliaments passed the Act of Union, which comes into effect in 1801, and it unites Great Britain and Ireland into a single official state known as the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. And James Hawes was talking in the previous episode about how that wasn't so much an effort to help Ireland, but to contain it and control it even more than before, because we have had ongoing problems between the Protestants in Ireland, who are all descended from English colonists, and the more native Catholic Irish. And there is this raging argument always about the rights of Catholics within the United Kingdom. Interestingly, it is at this point that George officially gives up the title of King of France, which the British monarchs had called themselves since the reign of Edward III. So at every coronation, they would have been crowned King of England, Scotland, wherever, and France. I mean, it's ridiculous. It would be like Charles III now saying, you know what, I'm going to call myself King of China as well, and I'll have a special crown for that. And some people suggested that George should adopt the title Emperor of the British Isles, but he rather wisely turned that one down. So William Pitt wanted to give increased freedom to the Catholics. He thought the restrictions on them were outdated and unjust, but George fiercely resisted, saying that he had made a coronation oath to maintain Protestantism, and therefore he could not allow the emancipation of Catholics. Pitt threatened to resign, and the stress of this tipped George into another period of madness. Pitt was soon replaced by a guy called Henry Addington. He doesn't seem to have been a particularly important character. You don't need to remember his name. I don't know why I even bothered mentioning him, other than to say that this is one of the periods where Pitt was voluntarily or forced to give up some of his power. A brief peace had been made with France, but nobody, in particular George, really believed that this would hold. And by 1803, the war was back on, at which point there was a serious threat of an invasion of England by Napoleon. George proclaimed that he was ready and able to lead his army in battle against the French should they land. And the coastal defences around, well, mainly around the south of England, were greatly enforced with these forts and Martello Towers, which are still very much a part of the British seaside landscape. So there is this increasing threat of the French coming against us, because we are the last power in Europe who are saying Napoleon must be stopped. And Napoleon was stopped. At least his naval invasion was stopped in 1805 by this great British admiral, Admiral Horatio Nelson, at the Battle of Trafalgar. Now, this wasn't the first time that Nelson had been up against Napoleon. I mentioned earlier that before Napoleon returned to France and did indeed take power there, he had been encouraged to go and fight in Egypt. Nelson took a fleet out there to have a go at him. And Nelson rather audaciously split his own fleet into two so that he was able to attack the French navy from both sides and trap them in a crossfire. This was very unconventional, and it was part of the overall British military tactic of saying, attack, attack, attack. And he destroyed the French fleet in what became known as the Battle of the Nile. And it's what he did again at Trafalgar. He split his naval force into two parts, and each one did a sort of parallel manoeuvre and got in amongst the French and wrecked their ships in what went down in history as one of our greatest military triumphs. It was around about this point that George recovers, Addington resigns, Pitt returns to power, and he starts trying to put together this third coalition, which I mentioned before, between Austria, Russia and Sweden. But he is old and in ill health. The stories of him attending Parliament wrapped up in blankets and supported by sticks. And he dies in 1806. But with these temporary victories against Napoleon, George becomes more popular. But that cannot help his decline in health. And by 1810, he's nearly blind from cataracts. He's in terrible pain from rheumatism. And he suffers his latest and worst relapse into what was categorised back then as madness. He also developed dementia at the same time. He's pretty elderly at this point. And from 1810, we have the Regency. 1810 to 1820 becomes the Regency period. Things happen on the home front. Interestingly, in 1812, the Prime Minister, Spencer Perceval, was assassinated. He is the only one of the British prime ministers to have been assassinated. At first, it was feared that this might be the start of an uprising, but it soon became clear that it had nothing to do with the war or with politics. The assassin, John Bellingham, was a merchant with a grudge against the government, a little bit unhinged. He believed he'd been unjustly imprisoned in Russia and was entitled to compensation, but nobody in Parliament would listen to him. If this happened today, the government would use it as an excuse to bring in some new and ill-thought-through laws, when in fact what you're dealing with is one irrational person. As I say, we'll look at the Regency period properly in the next episode. And in the meantime, Napoleon is still rampaging through Europe. Just as in the Second World War, where the British started attacking the fringes of German power in North Africa, before then moving into Europe. The same thing sort of happens in the Napoleonic Wars, where a British army is sent to Portugal. The Portuguese are holding out against the Spanish, who are allies of the French and are supporters of Napoleon. Some battles are won there. The British and Portuguese army advance out of Portugal into Spain. And Napoleon is becoming increasingly unpopular in Spain. The French army misbehaves quite badly. Napoleon installs his brother Joseph on the Spanish throne, which is very unpopular. And in the end, the Spanish turn against Napoleon, say, we don't want to be allied with you anymore. And we've got the support of this Portuguese and British army coming in from the west. As long as Napoleon is there in Spain, he can win. But as soon as he has to go elsewhere to fight other battles somewhere else in Europe, his armies in Spain are pretty rubbish. And this new young Irish commander comes in to lead the British forces in Spain, the Duke of Wellington. And this is, of course, the Peninsular War, which many of my listeners will be familiar with from the books and the TV series about Sharp, starring Sean Bean. As this young British officer, and Wellington grows and grows in stature and becomes pretty much the only man in Europe who can lead an army against Napoleon, although the first time that happens is at Waterloo. They never come up against each other in Spain. But the British army forces its way up through Spain. Spain engage in this warfare, which becomes known as guerrilla war or guerrilla war. This idea that you get your peasants hiding up in the mountains and they just come and have these raids against outposts of the French army before disappearing back into the countryside. Again, this is a new form of warfare, and it's one that's going to be taken up around the world. Eventually, the British come out of Spain and up through France. Napoleon has foolishly weakened himself by trying to fight the Russians. In 1812, he was forced to retreat from Russia. And the basic fact is that Russia is just too big to be invaded by anyone at any time. So Napoleon retreats back into France. The wars still continue, however, but Napoleon has lost momentum. He's lost his edge, his aura. He has some further successes, but his military commanders are getting fed up and starting to turn on him. And the powers in Paris are getting fed up. They want an end to it. And Napoleon eventually surrenders himself to the Allies, who exile him to the island of Elba in the Mediterranean in 1814. He doesn't stay there long, however. The French soldiers back home are saying, "What happened there? Why did we do that?" Napoleon was making France great again. So Napoleon jumps off Elba, returns to the mainland, marches up to Paris, collecting supporters as he goes, and he gets ready for the big one, a final military showdown. Mainly between his French troops and English troops under Wellington and Prussian troops under Prince Blücher. And it all comes to a head at the Battle of Waterloo on the 18th of June, 1815. Wellington's army managed to hold up against the French and eventually broke them. And that was it for Napoleon. This time he was exiled to St. Helena in the middle of the Atlantic, and he never came back. But King George III knew nothing of this. He was lost in a world of his own. He also didn't know that he was declared King of Hanover in 1814. On the back of the first French defeat and various treaties that were made, certain of these German provinces, like Hanover, were made monarchies. George also didn't know that his beloved wife, Charlotte, had died in 1818. In Christmas 1819, he apparently spoke nonsense for 58 hours on end. And for the last few weeks of his life, he was blind, mad, demented. He couldn't walk. And eventually he died of pneumonia at Windsor Castle at the beginning of 1820. Now, the other big issue during George's reign was that of slavery. It's such a complex issue that I'm going to be doing a whole separate episode about slavery with Onyeka Nubia. And also in the course of that, we're going to look at the history of black people in Britain, which is really a lot more interesting and extensive than I certainly realised. George himself was not a slave owner. He'd never owned any slaves. But of course, he, like most people in Britain, had massively benefited from the slave trade. He actually wrote that slavery was a ridiculous idea. It was a terrible idea and shouldn't be allowed. And yet, ironically, he resisted any moves to get rid of slavery for 20 years. And again, if you listen to the separate episode, they could make more sense of this, about how everybody was caught up in the economics of the whole thing. It has to be said that, like, for instance, in the 1790s, almost 400,000 Africans were shipped to the Americas on these voyages that originally set out from British ports, like Liverpool and Bristol. And there had been early moves towards the emancipation of the slaves in the Americas. For instance, in the American Civil War, the British government said that if any slaves escaped or rose up against their American owners, they would be considered free men by the British and they could join the British army. And we looked at the idea that in the American War of Independence, you basically have the English on one side, which are the American colonists, who are largely of English descent and would have spoken with English accents. They allied with the French, So you have this English-French army fighting the British army, which is mainly Scots, Irish. There are also quite a lot of Germans from Hanover. So it's incredibly diverse. And there are also slaves. There are slaves fighting on both sides. And, you know, the American patriots say, well, you know, you look at the American War of Independence, there were 5,000 black men fighting for the Revolutionary Army, these freed slaves. Well, there were 20,000 fighting for the British Army against them. So that was, in some ways, a first move towards the ending of slavery. And in 1807, George finally relented and signed an act for the abolition of the slave trade. Now, what's interesting about this Act of 1807 is it did not ban slavery. Slavery as a system was allowed to continue, but as far as the British were concerned, they were not allowed to be involved in the so-called trade of taking them from Africa across the Atlantic and selling them in the colonies, and neither could any British landowners in the Caribbean buy slaves anymore. They could still keep the slaves they owned, however. So this was not the abolition of slavery in Britain. It was the abolition of the slave trade. And it was to be another 35 years before slavery was actually abolished in the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833. Although even then, there were certain places within the British Empire that you were allowed to keep slaves, such as the possessions of the East India Company in places like India and Sri Lanka. So anyway, that was King George. He certainly lived through a lot of history. And in the last episode, James Hawes looked at how Britain became this huge, powerful international country and created this great wealth, largely on the back of the Industrial Revolution and the use of coal initially to drive this great engine. What do we think of King George? Originally, he was nicknamed Farmer George by the satirists as a way to take the piss out of him, saying he was this simpleton who was only interested in the rather mundane things of life, like growing vegetables. But it eventually became a term of endearment. George was seen as a man of the people, particularly in contrast to his son, the Prince of Wales, the Prince Regent, who lived a very different lifestyle, as we shall see in the next episode. The British people also loved him because he stayed married to one woman and didn't have any mistresses and was very pious. Seems that standards for why you would love a monarch were quite low at the time. So be sure to carry on listening after the break, when my guest will be Ian Hislop.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back. My guest today is a national treasure, the journalist, satirist and television personality Ian Hislop, who will be very familiar to British listeners as one of the team captains on the long-running satirical news quiz, Have I Got News For You? Along with his writing partner Nick Newman, Ian also created the comedy character of Tim Nice But Dim for Harry Enfield. So Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Very exciting to be welcomed on, as though I knew anything about any subject, which is great.
Was it fair to say that you are interested in the idea of Britishness and what history means to us?
Yes, hugely. I'm also very interested in this period, partly through, the portal of satire.
Yes.
Because I got to know it through people being rude about it, and I wanted to know why they were and what they were saying, and that was the way I came to it, particularly to George, whose son, the Prince Regent, was sort of a massive and fabulous target for satirists because he was fat and drank and smoked and was louche and was a libertine and created some amazing images. So, I mean, satirists do like going for the obvious. there's nothing quite like it. And he was really obvious, the Prince Regent. But his father was a much more difficult character to pin down. And I think aroused my interest because of that.
Well, yes. I mean, many of our listeners will know that we did a special episode of the podcast from the Chalk Valley History Festival in 2023, where I asked you, Tom Holland and Leander Delisle, to choose your most and least favourite monarchs. And you chose as your favourite George III, and your least favourite, his son, the aforementioned George IV. So I thought it would be really interesting to get you back to expand on what it was you liked about George III.
When I was young, and I know this series is sort of based on this kings and queens idea.
Yes.
We had a wall chart, and the length of reign of each monarch was expressed as a pillar. And the obvious ones were very long, Queen Victoria. And then there was this enormous pillar, George III. I mean, nearly 60 years on the throne. And I remember as a child thinking, well, no one says anything very nice about him or even very much about him, pre-Alan Bennett.
Yes.
So I was intrigued and I thought, what is it about George that made him last so long? And, you know, he saw... In 60 years, it ends with the Napoleonic Wars and begins just before the Seven Years' War. I mean, it's full of wars, obviously, how we define history. But his own reign was, I felt, and I increasingly feel, quite similar to Queen Elizabeth's, the other incredibly long-running, because he had an incredibly sort of dedicated notion of national service. He kept making speeches about how his whole life was about whether this great country was happy or unhappy, how he was very moral. He may not have been the cleverest person ever, and I don't mean that with disrespect to, you know, the late Queen or anyone else, but he was solid and stolid and a bit boring, to be honest, which is... a quality that I've grown to appreciate more and more.
Appreciate in someone in charge, yes. Oh, for boring politicians, really, isn't it?
Yes, and I think that both in his domestic life, which was sort of impeccable, and he was in love with his own wife and then stayed with her the whole time, which is a completely ridiculous idea in the history of the British royal family. And allegations of personal corruption by later historians seem to have been largely dismissed. He doesn't appear to have been bent. He appears to have viewed being king as a really important constitutional job. And you think of, you know, that early speech by Queen Elizabeth when she was the princess, you know, in black and white in front of the microphone, where there's this incredibly earnest young person dedicating themselves. And George, I mean, he was 18. You know, his father died, like the late Queen. He wasn't really expecting this job yet, or if at all. And he was incredibly not oppressed by it, but it became a very heavy responsibility.
To take it seriously, yeah. Which, let's face it, not every monarch had done up to this point. But it's through the Georgian era that politicians finally take over from our monarchs and basically run the country, don't they? And people always ask about the monarchs up to this point, and also about politicians, and they're still asking it today about politicians. Do they seek power because they want to do what they genuinely believe is best for the ordinary people? Or do they want to impose their ideas of what they think Britain should be? Or do they do it to enrich themselves and their friends?
Yes, which is a perfectly good idea. And I think we're used to thinking historically, well, in the old days, everybody was out for themselves. And the only point of it was favours and contracts and manoeuvring amongst aristocratic families. And George is quite interesting because he is a constitutional monarch. The advantages of a constitutional monarch, they're not the same as the people manoeuvring around them. And I mean, history has been much kinder to George than it was either at the time or shortly afterwards in assessing the fact that after his reign, as you say, it became absolutely clear that this is the way the monarchy would function.
I mean, he did start out trying to sort of throw his weight around a bit. The Whigs tried to picture him as a sort of a despot.
Yes.
And again, the Americans did the same thing. But yes, as you say, that seems to be being reassessed. And actually, he seemed more of a trying to be conciliatory by the end.
I mean, you know how much I like football. So it's very much a reign of two halves, isn't it? You know, because he was there for so long, he actually got quite good at the job.
Until he went completely mad.
Until he went completely mad, that's true. And okay, a game of two halves and then a sort of extra time, which wasn't very good.
A disastrous penalty shootout.
But he, you know, he made a lot of mistakes in the early days, I think. And he did try and throw his weight around, and the government was very incoherent. But then he had this sort of moment of inspiration in which he appointed, you know, William Pitt the Younger, you know, who was about 11. and maybe that's just in Blackadder. But
I think he was actually 24 when he was made Prime Minister, but still ridiculously young.
This incredible young man who, you know, the others didn't want, who became an extraordinary Prime Minister and a source of stability for a decade, and under whom extraordinary things happened. Because Pitt was the friend of Wilberforce, who then, you know, started the anti-slavery movement, which... in the end, it happened under George.
The first steps, yes.
Yes.
Abolishing the trade rather than the act of
the act.
The act of slavery.
But, you know, the trade was what the British were most involved in, and therefore it was sort of hugely significant. So yeah. I think, yes, I think that is entirely true. Early on, he tried to throw his weight around, and later he realised that he had to put up with ministers he didn't like much if they were expressing the will of the commons or they were popular. And he ended up as a real national treasure. I mean, he was unlucky to go mad at the height of his popularity.
Yes, I was talking about this earlier in the episode about how this insult Farmer George, he kind of turned it around and became a man of the people and in many ways embodied Englishness.
And this was from a family who, you know, everyone took the piss out of them being German for most of the time.
So, yes, perhaps he was a bit of a dull plodder, but rather that than his son. I mean, it seems that the regency was almost presented as a contrast, George III's opposite. You don't want a boring, well-behaved king like me? Well, would you rather have this instead?
And the cartoonists, the farmer thing was sort of very funny earlier on because you could put him in a silly farmer's hat and assume he was sort of ill-educated and only interested in turnips. And obviously, you know, that was immensely amusing for cartoonists. But what he ended up doing was being the king who insisted on what we now call food security, which is if we're going to be at war with Europe the whole time, perhaps we should grow some food here. So that there's something to eat when everyone else is at war. And, you know, this week, like many weeks, that's what DEFRA is going on about. Is food security important anymore? And post-Ukraine and post our departure in Brexit, these are issues that come up again. So the farmer tag, like many of the things with him, turned into something that was rather impressive.
He owned it.
He owned it
in modern
parlance. That's right. And you know, again, this is very rare for the royal family. I mean, he did read.
Yeah, well, books seem to have been his thing. Yes, he amassed a very good library, didn't he?
And they say he wasn't a very good student. You know, he was called a dull boy and rather slow. But he bought an awful lot of books, which he seemed to have spent time reading. And the nation benefited from this because the King's Library turned, I think it's in the British Museum now.
It's in the British Library, actually, that they've built this rather lovely sort of tower to keep it in.
And then he established a Royal Observatory because he was interested in science.
Yeah, the King's Observatory in Richmond Park.
And he was interested in astronomy. And he begins to sound like one of those European monarchs who everyone goes on about, immensely enlightened and interesting.
If only he'd ridden a bicycle.
Yeah, that was a failure, the non-adopting of the bicycle. But do you know what I mean? It's as we go further from the received picture of him, the more you get this feeling that there are some qualities there that obviously over 60 years were incredibly useful to the country.
Well, I think the whole Farmer George thing, there are parallels with King Charles, starting out banging on about the ecology and green things and everyone laughing at him and calling him a tree hugger who talked to his plants, and now they're all saying, well, actually, He was right.
Yes, and the plants had a great deal to say of interest, which he obviously listened to and absorbed. And the same is true. He was a fogey talking about architecture and the prayer book at times when not many people were very interested in that. And now the rejection of ugly architecture and modernism for its own sense is mainstream. And everyone says, oh, yes, Prince Charles, I always liked that. And again, being slightly before your time is never very popular.
No, and you never get thanked for it afterwards.
No, never. I mean, it's mostly Thatcher's. I blame them.
Well, talking about, I'm going to do an episode with Alice Loxton.
Ah, yes, she's very brilliant.
She is, and Uproar is mainly about Gilray Rowlandson and Cruikshank and the birth of the political cartoon. And they sort of set the template, didn't they, for how these things look. You know, very well drawn, full of interest and detail, speech balloons, a certain type of exaggeration and caricature. They're often very scatological. And they have a lot of fun with allegory. And that does tend to be the style that most political cartoons in our newspapers are still drawn in today.
It does. I mean, Private Eye is hugely influenced by the Georgian satirists, by Gilray, by Cruikshank, and by Hogarth before them. Because
yes,
these are the jokes there are. And half the time, I find myself, we come up with what I think is a brilliant idea, and it's about 300 years old. And done repeatedly by someone else. But they were, in this sort of golden age, they were very good artists. That is one thing which you can't guarantee. I mean, the ability to draw as well as Gilray is an absolutely fabulous artist. You know, Cruikshank are pretty good too. They were also very, very funny. And they didn't agree on anything. I mean, Gilray was, I mean, nowadays, exhibitions, they have to put up little stickers saying he was very anti-French in an inappropriate way. And, I mean, he was pretty right-wing on a number of the issues, you know, the Irish emancipation of Catholics or any of those things. Gilray's sentiments were pretty solidly John Bullish and down the line. But, again, that isn't really the genius we're talking about. What he was doing was rudely depicting the politics of the day. And yes, his own opinion comes through. There is some issue too about when he took a whole load of money from the government in the form of a pension, which he was very quiet about. And in his later years, this was used to discredit him by other cartoonists, many of whom hadn't been offered a pension and would probably have taken it. But it was one way of slightly toning down his views about the government in that he actually took a pension off them. But I mean, they are brilliant. The depictions of Fox and the depictions of Pitt are incredibly good.
And of the two Georges as well.
Yes, and your earlier point is absolutely right. The whole point of having a father and son combination like this is contrast. And there's nothing satirists like more than a really obvious contrast between two people's lifestyle. So you have sober, diligent, boring King and wild, fat, libertine, louche. I mean, there's a wonderful drawing called The Voluptuary, which is a picture of the Prince Regent, which, again, I mean, it looks so much like Boris Johnson that it's absurd. It's impossible. I mean, so many Private Eye readers send it in repeatedly saying, have you noticed this lookalike, our former Prime Minister and the Prince Regent? I will say, yes, I have noticed. Even I've seen this. And that, again, I mean, it's a funny picture of the voluptuary, because not only is the person smoking and drinking, there's a series of sort of medical bills and various diseases hinted at in the background of the picture, plus debts. There are some fairly obvious parallels which are very enjoyable. The father was very useful as a contrast to his son. There's a very good picture by Cruikshank of the son, the Prince Regent, dancing with someone else's wife a bit close at some grand ball and eating too much. And outside in the window, you can see the fields are empty and there's a famine. And half the country appears to be starving at this point. Again, I mean, it's a very good cartoon, but it's very useful having someone who embodies all the vices as the counterpoint to the ruling person.
the sort of freedom enjoyed by the satirists of the time to openly mock the powers that be. It does seem to have been fairly unique in Europe.
Yes, and that is an extraordinary achievement, I think, of the cartoonists and the pamphleteers and the booksellers and the people who defended them, in that that golden age gave us the liberties we now enjoy. It is now not only acceptable in British political culture, but, you know, compulsory to pretend that you find satire amusing. Yes. As a politician, you have to grit your teeth and say, oh, this is very much part of our democratic process, you know, when you hate it and you would really like to close everyone down. But they tried that repeatedly. And Nick Newman and I wrote a play about a great trial in 1812, which, again, George was a bit mad by then, but his ministers certainly weren't, and nor was the Prince Regent. And this wonderful writer and bookseller called Hone, William Hone, was put on trial, and he was aided and abetted by George Cruikshank, who was a cartoonist who'd illustrated the work. But they went for Hone, and they tried him three times on three consecutive days. So the jury on the first day found him not guilty, so they just charged him again. And he had to appear the next morning. And this was in the Guildhall in London.
And what was it that he
seditious libel
published
and
written?
Blasphemy.
A specific work or just a general body?
It was about three different works. And they were all parodies, usually parodies of the Lord's Prayer or parodies of the Book of Common Prayer, because that's what everyone read. Right. So, I mean, his standard joke was the Lord's Prayer was about the House of Lords. And then he'd do jokes about the king and jokes about the Trinity being the king and his son. And other. They were blasphemous only in the sense that they weren't about God or religion at all. They were about the king.
And so did the powers that be try to use the blasphemy angle as a way of getting
That's exactly him. Right. And you'll find this is very common in modern theocratic states all over the Middle East and elsewhere. Is you say this is blasphemy, and what you mean, it's blasphemy against me as the ruler. It's disgraceful to do this. But there weren't that many unifying things to parody. And what you listened to in church was the obvious one. So they did a lot of that.
And so they tried him three times. And
on the third trial, there was a mob of about 25,000 people outside the Guildhall. And the authorities thought, if he's innocent today, we may have to let it ride. And he was. And three times he was found innocent in 3 days. He defended himself. Fantastic speeches. Well, he wrote an account of the trial afterwards in which his speeches are amazingly brilliant. Whether they were at the time, it's difficult to tell.
Right. But those are the ones you used in your play,
indeed,
presumably.
Because...
And was the sort of the clamp down there coming from the government or from the monarchy? Or
I think it was joint. I mean, the Prince Regent was extraordinarily touchy. That was another of his attitudes.
Oh, right. So this is during the Regency, of
yes.
course. Yes.
This was during the Regency. So at this point, it wasn't George III, who I think was more measured about these things. But the Regent was particularly touchy, and suggestions that he was fat in particular, he found very, very hurtful. And suggestions about his mistresses, he really didn't like very much. And so there was a personal aspect to the Regency. But also, his ministers were constantly at fear that Britain was going to turn into France and that we would have a revolution.
Yes.
And I mean, after it was only 1789, it was very recent in everyone's memory that tumbrils could start rolling down Whitehall and the aristocratic families and the ministers would be for the chop. I mean, there was genuine fear, so that anyone who expressed anti-government or liberal views was immediately characterised as a Jacobin or French about to kill everybody immediately. So they were genuinely scared. But what they didn't realise was that the very process of allowing dissent would mean that there wasn't a revolution in Britain.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be that the British ruling classes learned that if you tolerated these people, if you let them say what they want and draw what they want, it doesn't matter that much. It won't lead to the collapse of the government and the end of the monarchy. I mean, in some ways, it's the opposite, isn't it? I mean, as you just said, I mean, it's a pressure valve. It's always struck me how frustrating it must be for satirists like yourselves to think, at the end of the day, did we make any difference? You know, I remember back in Margaret Thatcher's time, obviously huge amount of fun being made at her expense, and the birth of the Spitting Image TV programme with these amazing satirical puppets and portraying her and her cabaret as a bunch of villains and buffoons and idiots. And it just made her more popular.
Oh, eventually she resigned.
Well, she did, but suddenly these cabinet members became a bunch of daft characters.
Yes, and
not just a bunch of faceless politicians.
And I do think satirists always have to have a certain modesty about their ability to change anything. One remembers Peter Cook's famous remark about the satirists in the Berlin cabarets. Well, they certainly stopped Hitler. Oh no, they didn't. And people like Jonathan Swift, who... probably the greatest satirist of all, people said, well, what did he ever change? But I think what he did do, I mean, he was certainly a massive influence in Ireland, and he did contribute to the debate. If you don't topple the government, at least you are providing a way of saying what the opposition wants to say in a very direct way. And I think that the Georgian satirists proved hugely useful in creating pictures of excess, because they were terribly popular, from the displays in the print shops to the cheap prints available of their work. They did sort of crystallise an opinion. They did say, well, this is absurd, this is ridiculous. And that all feeds into the process. So I do believe that, pompous as it is.
So do you think that the characterisation of George IV and the attacks on him for his excess, did that, do you think, lead towards the sort of Victorian era of we must all behave and our monarchs must behave, be more like George the
Third? Yeah, I think it was part of the bridge between what we think of Georgian rakish behaviour to a sense of, well, maybe there is such a thing as institutional morality and there are standards which we should apply in public life. And people always imagine the Victorians is, you say Victorians, people say, oh, hypocrites. But that does imply they were trying to impose some standards and fell short of them or only paid lip service to them. But they were there. Whereas the Georgian period, people are saying, well, we'll do whatever we like. See how that goes. So there's a certain amount of cant there.
So the reputations of historical figures change all the time. It certainly seems with George that he's forever being reevaluated. And you certainly see him in a fairly positive light.
I do think with George, there was a feeling that we know two things about him. He lost the colonies. Isn't that terrible? Well, A, is it? B, was it his fault? Again, if you take your history from Hamilton, it was entirely his fault, because there's a very funny song in the middle of the musical. And I mean, in many ways, the best bit of the musical, in which George III does a funny song. About how furious he is about the loss of the colonies and how he can't bear it and he won't recover. So we know that from Hamilton, and then we know from Alan Bennett that he went mad. And, I mean, because Bennett is incredibly funny, there is the moment where he characterises having... We had two prime ministers called Pitt the Elder and Pitt the Younger, and then George's physicians are looking at his urine and one says, this is piss the younger, and gets out another sample and says, this is piss the elder. And it's very, very funny. And it's, I mean, and again, it's quite a moving end. I mean, because George did have a sound. So we know the highlights of George, but I think what I'm interested in is that around that, between losing the colonies and going mad, there was a very, very long period of George stabilising both a parliamentary and constitutional system and defining a slightly different way of behaviour for a British monarch, which is unignored, obviously, but which I think is interesting, and which you can see that echoing down through Victoria, through Elizabeth, through some of our more earnest monarchs. You know, I'm sure King Charles would have George III in mind I mean, there are no more colonies to lose, I think, unless we blow it and Pitcairn's gone. But she probably has already. I'm sure Charles is aware of that history of the Ernest monarch.
Yeah. I do think it was a shame that he fought Pitt over the emancipation of Catholics, and that maybe Irish history would have gone very differently and better for the Irish if he had allowed the Catholics more
freedom. Yes, I mean, if you're putting a score sheet down of plus points, you know, he read books, minus points, he was very Anglican, and part of the earnestness of his job was he thought to resist the papacy in all its incarnations. That involved a lot of not giving jobs to people who were Catholics, and therefore not treating Ireland with the respect, and certainly not the educated and other classes who needed to be given these jobs. And he fought Pitt, and it is the subject of one of Gilray's cartoons, in which the king is throwing out Pitt and the others, saying, "How dare you? You'd think I'm an idiot. I'm going to fall for this papist lunacy." You know, they're not always on the right side, satirists. And you are right. I mean, that is absolutely a failure of that reign. But again, this is a problem that confronted every single subsequent prime minister.
Well, on that note, I think we still have George coming out on the plus side.
I hope so. There were definite failures. And obviously, Hanoverian family life never went well. Both the sons ended up hating their fathers. He had a sad end, sort of melancholy end, a pretty good middle. So he was, in the great range of monarchs you covered, still a pretty positive one.
Well, thank you so much, Ian, for joining me today and sharing your, I would say, love of George.
Respect.
Yes.
I mean,
George.
I am perfectly aware that I would have joined all the other satirists and cartoonists in having a go at him.
But you would have enjoyed having a go at
much more. It's John Major and Boris, isn't it? We know where we are.
So that was George III, and huge thanks to my guest Ian Hislop for giving us his take on Farmer George. Now, I got three excellent episodes coming up looking at other aspects of things that were going on in the Georgian era. And in particular, if you're interested in finding out more about the satirists we've been talking about, make sure you listen to the episode with Alice Loxton. Now, Ian's play about the trial of William Hone is called Trial by Laughter. And you can buy the script as a book. And I know I probably shouldn't say this because I'm not sure how official some of these sites are. But you can find the version of the play that was done for BBC Radio 4 online if you look for it. So be sure to join me on the next episode as we continue our romp through Georgian Britain. Follow the podcast now to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Willy Willy Harry Stee was written and presented by me, Charlie Higson, with music by Tom Jenkins and production by Mark Jeeves. Willy Willy Harry Stee, the podcast, is the copyright of Charlie Higson, 2024.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.